Good evening. It's nice to see everybody here on such a nice evening. This forum tonight is, as we do every year, with the Al and Helen Reynolds good help, is co-sponsored by the UNUSA organization locally. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the good works they do, I'm sure that Helen and Al will be glad to chat you up following the forum. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum. The International Peace Institute is an independent international institution that promotes the prevention and settlement of armed conflicts between and within states through policy research and development. Today's forum speaker is Edward C. Luck, who is a senior vice president and director of studies at the International Peace Institute. Dr. Luck, who was educated at Dartmouth College and earned his graduate degrees at Columbia University, has spent much of his career working with and writing about international organizations. From 1974 until 1994, Luck was at the United Nations Association of the USA, where he served as president and CEO during the last 10 years of his tenure there. He was founder and executive director of the Center for the Study of International Organization, a research center jointly established by the School of Law at NYU and the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. He currently is on leave as professor of practice in international and public affairs of the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. In February of 2008, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appointed Professor Luck as special advisor and assistant secretary general. Please welcome Edward Luck.
Thank you, George. This is, for me, a first. It's a first to Charlottesville, which I've heard for many years is one of the more delightful places on earth, and certainly the first to the University of Virginia and to the Miller Center. It obviously is not the first time I've spoken to a meeting co-sponsored by the UN Association, so I'm delighted that so many friends and colleagues are here. I was planning to talk basically about the UN and this notion of the responsibility to protect, which is what I'm working on for the Secretary General. But this also is a somewhat August day in American politics, so I couldn't resist the temptation saying a word or two about the election, about the implications for the UN and the US relationship with the UN. Now, I should probably make a caveat about that first. Since I have several hats, and one of them is as a special advisor to the Secretary General, I'm forbidden to interfere in the internal affairs of any member state, including that of which I happen to be a native, and happens to be a rather powerful one that isn't usually worried about interference in its affairs. But nevertheless, I will put on my academic hat to say a word or two about the U.S., if I might, and then go on a bit to the UN and to the responsibility to protect. Now, I have heard that this is a fairly liberal institution here, but when George sent my instructions, it said 27 minutes for speaking. So I don't know if I go 28 or 26, what happens, but I will try to be pretty good about that to leave enough time for a discussion. Like many of you, I stayed up rather late last night to hear the President-elect acceptance speech, which I thought was delivered in an especially impressive way and obviously a very special occasion for the country and for the world. I noted that, among other things, he spoke about a new dawn of American global leadership. And of course, the commentators are quick to talk about that today. And I must say, had this election been held at the UN and among the member states, we would not have waited so long for the results. He was very, very popular with most of the member states almost from day one. And it's interesting, many of the things that made him sort of hard, I think, to catch on with the American body politic, the sort of that he epitomized in so many ways, multiculturalism, being really a citizen of the world in many places, having ties to Kenya and to Indonesia, only lastly to continental U.S., given his years in Hawaii. is a product, I'm glad to say, of Columbia University. This is a good thing that we're very proud of. But he has a certain way about him, which I think is very appealing to international audiences. And expectations are very, very high. And what I've discovered over the last 6-8 months through the primaries and through the general campaign is that many delegates from countries that are not especially friendly towards the US or are very skeptical about American foreign policy, are very worried about the exercise of American power, somehow think that the election of Barack Obama would make all of the difference. And many of them have said it would change their attitudes about what the US is all about. Because they didn't think this could ever happen here, that we could actually elect an African-American president. So I think what we have now on both sides really is a question about managing expectations. There is a feeling, I don't know if it's right or not, that the president-elect and people who are likely to be in his administration will want to invest more of American foreign policy in multilateralism generally, and in the UN in particular. There is a strong feeling, I think, in the country that we've lost respect around the world, and part of this is by going around the Security Council, around the UN, in terms of the war in Iraq. Now, whatever your politics are, there is a feeling that, in fact, when you shift from a Republican administration to a Democratic administration, you have a little more embrace of the UN and international institutions. Now, I'm a little worried about this management of expectations on both sides. Because in some ways, with President Bush, he came in, unlike his father, who was quite enthusiastic about the UN and had been an ambassador there. But when George W. Bush became president, as you recall, he was not terribly enthusiastic about the UN and international institutions. And often was rather deprecating in his comments about them. But he had a learning curve. And I think what we find is that even presidents who come in without much enthusiasm learn they have to do a lot of the work of American foreign policy through international institutions. And while that is often a very frustrating experience, it is also a necessary part of bringing larger coalitions on to support our goals in the world. So I wouldn't suggest that this president is leaving office as a great enthusiast for the UN, but if you look at the degree of engagement of the United States, particularly in the Security Council, it's gone up enormously in recent years, not only for peripheral items, but central items of our foreign policy. You think, for example, of Iran and non-proliferation kinds of issues. You think of so many of the peacekeeping missions around the world and how much the numbers have increased over the years of the Bush presidency. You think the newfound interest in development, even under this administration, how much of that is coming through the UN. So whether they liked it or not, over time they decided, yes, the UN is fairly important for us. So he started at a low level of engagement, ended at a rather high level of engagement. And my worry is that a new administration coming in now may begin at a high level of engagement and then experience all the frustrations of trying to do business with 191 other member states and with a rather complicated and rather slow to move bureaucracy in the organization. And that there could be frustrations. And I think back to the beginning of the Clinton administration. Again, a Democratic president elected to follow a Republican president at a time of great economic crisis. And you remember the slogan of that campaign, you know, it's the economy, stupid. Well, they haven't used quite that slogan, but clearly in the election, that was the dominant issue. That's why Barack Obama won. And there'd be a great temptation to sort of look inward to economic healing and maybe even to a certain amount of protectionism and other things, which actually would be somewhat anathema to other countries. So I don't want others to assume that because we have a new president, American foreign policy changes, you know, 180 degrees, that American interests change fundamentally. And I wouldn't want a new American administration to think everything's going to be very easy as long as you invoke multilateral cooperation. It's going to come very, very readily. Because if you actually remember the first term or two of the Clinton administration, it was actually quite a rough time with the UN. It was not an easy time. It was a time when, in fact, we began to pull back from peacekeeping after a sudden rise in the amount of peacekeeping around the world. After the Somalia intervention and after Mogadishu, there was a real retreat The president, in his very first General Assembly meeting, had this infamous phrase that unless the UN learns to say no, the American people won't learn to say yes. As if we did not have a veto already in the Security Council, but he was saying somehow the organization was out of control and voting for all these new peacekeeping missions around the world. And he had a majority, a Democratic majority in Congress. But the voices of a Republican minority that were more cautious about these engagements seemed very often to get his ear. And in fact, it was a rather rough time. We had very large arrears. In fact, he signed the legislation that led to the largest arrears of all, which is on our peacekeeping dues. It was arbitrarily set. We were paying no more than a certain level, even though our dues were a good deal higher than that. Now, when he signed that legislation, President Clinton said, you know, I think this is wrong, but I'm signing it anyway, because there are other things that were on his mind at the moment. Now, if we look at the world at the present time, there is a great opportunity for American leadership. Because the world, quite frankly, from my viewpoint, is lacking leadership. And nature abhors a vacuum and nothing more than a power vacuum in the world. With the U.S. so involved in two rather uncertain wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there is, in fact, a lot of talk about emerging powers. You know, India or Brazil or Russia or China or others. But quite frankly, it's going to be a while before these emerging powers actually have much clout in international institutions, in international decision-making processes. And of course, part of that problem is the question of the makeup of the Security Council. But it does seem to me China is not quite ready. The EU as a collective, I think, has a hard time operating as effectively as it might. So I think we see most of the so-called emerging powers punching a little below their weight in international institutions. We have the non-aligned movement, of course, 130-some countries, but there is such a diversity now of economic power and geopolitical interest among the non-aligned that they're not all that coherent either. So I think what we see often in the UN is not that there's leadership that is giving us problems, but the lack of leadership is a problem again and again. So there would seem to be a place for the U.S. To move in, and with a new dynamic president who starts with a little bit of a honeymoon period with the other member states, maybe there are some opportunities here. But I think I would caution a new administration to be very careful about how this is exercised. And let me turn now to this question of the responsibility to protect and sort of some of the peace and security role of the UN and how that relates to American power. Now, some of you have probably heard of this idea of a responsibility to protect. It really rests on existing international law and the obligations of states to protect their people from four crimes and violations: genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. Now, three of those four, other than ethnic cleansing, are very well grounded in international law. And ethnic cleansing more and more is something which can, in fact, be a crime under the other three. So it has a strong basis. And in 2005 at the World Summit, unanimously all the heads of state and government, so the very highest level, agreed that they, in fact, will protect their citizens from these four things. And they not only prevent these crimes, but they also prevent their incitement. And they commit themselves to doing that. And they have a couple paragraphs of the outcome document from that summit, which lay out the beginnings about how they go about doing this. The problem, of course, like many things at the UN, is the rhetoric is great, the delivery is a little less certain, more uneven. So again, the normative role of the UN in building international law, building international principle, has moved forward in this area in very impressive ways. But now the question comes, how do you operationalize this? How do you make countries live up to this commitment? And what can the international community do to help countries, in fact, to reach this kind of commitment? Now, the reason I think this fits in with the question of American politics right now is that particularly for, I think, this new incoming administration and knowing many of the people who are likely to populate it, there is a great interest in helping people in situations like Darfur, like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, like in Somalia, where in fact hundreds of thousands of people are facing violence for one reason or another, where international conflict more and more is targeted against civilian, targeted against women, targeted against children, where systematic rape and sexual violence has become a norm of contemporary international conflict, where either states that are out of control or rebel groups that are out of control are completely ignoring the norms that traditionally have governed war and that have unfortunately been very much lost. I mean, even UN personnel and other humanitarian personnel who used to be sort of sacrosanct on the battlefield now have become the targets. They're kidnapped, they're killed, whatever, because people want to chase the international community away from these kinds of conflicts. So the question is this going to be a welding of American power and sort of international principle? Is this the kind of area for a new president that's going to be very tempting to move into? We see all the NGO groups, the other groups, talking about possible genocide in Darfur, organizing on a transnational basis, the question about the genocide games in Beijing, and all the publicity these things are getting. It's something that moves a lot of people, a lot of college students, frankly, among others. On the internet, other groups about trying to prevent genocide and trying to stop these kinds of atrocities. So it seemed to be a natural with a new president looking for a way of using American power, a principle that has great appeal to American publics and international publics, to put these together somehow. But let me say a word or two about how the Secretary General is approaching this and a couple of cautions about American leadership in this particular area. The Secretary General has asked me to come in and to help, one, to try to get the concept straight, so that everyone around the UN system, which, as you know, is a very diverse system, has the same idea of what the responsibility to protect is all about. And we have been working on that with about 20 entities across the board, because if you sit in human rights, it looks like human rights. If you sit in humanitarian affairs, it looks like a humanitarian issue. If you sit in peacekeeping, it looks like this is something facing peacekeepers day after day. If you're in political affairs, it looks like it's prevention and mediation is the key to this. If you're looking in development, it looks like long-term development is a way of preventing this. If you're post-conflict peace building, this is the key. This is a way of going about it. So there's many, many different ways of seeing this, and trying to pull it together in a single concept has not been so easy bureaucratically. But now we've actually been able to do this, and so the Secretary General is now able to speak, and he gave a major speech in Berlin in July 15, laying out his conception, his vision of what responsibility to protect is all about. The second step on this that I've been asked to do is try to find a bureaucratic way of doing this, finding some home for this within the UN, and looking at how we can sharpen the tools to deal with these kinds of things. And we're starting in a modest kind of way, but with the real emphasis on what exists in the system. There is a small office on genocide prevention and a special advisor on the prevention of genocide. Now, what R2P brings to this is that you have many situations that are atrocities that shock anyone's conscience, but may not be genocide. You look at Cambodia and the killing fields of the 1970s, 1.5 million people slaughtered, mostly because they were educated or looked too cosmopolitan or whatever, and the Khmer Rouge didn't trust them. But most scholars say, well, but that's not genocide. Yeah, sure, it's 1.5 million people, but it didn't have an ethnic or religious character. And therefore, it's more a politicide. It was done for political reasons as opposed to these other reasons. So, you know, we debate it in academic circles as to whether it's genocide or not. And so maybe these kinds of cases shouldn't be dealt with by the special advisor. But R2P, that's the acronym for Responsibility to Protect, if you're looking at ethnic cleansing, you're looking at crimes against humanity, you're looking at war crimes, in addition to genocide, you're looking at many things that might be precursors to genocide. And you don't have to worry about intent so much. You focus on the action and the results, and are these enough to trigger a response? So we're looking to combine these into a single effort in the UN system. Now, many people say, okay, the key is prevention and the key is early warning. Fair enough. So where do you get your information and what do you do with it? And we look around and we see that now in human rights alone, under the High Commissioner for Human Rights, there are about 1,000 workers out in the field in 50 different countries, generally trouble spots, looking at the human rights conditions, trying to encourage the governments or rebel groups to observe international human rights standards. And they have their own flow of information back to Geneva, back to the High Commissioner's office. And they have their own way of analyzing it and collating it and understanding it. You have now in OCHA, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, you've got 1,000 workers around the world in places that have huge humanitarian challenges. And they, again, pass their information back to headquarters into New York. You have more peacekeepers in more countries than ever before. And again, they have their own information systems. The Department of Political Affairs, looking for mediation, looking for conflict prevention, they have people in many of these trouble spots as well. And you have the same thing with UNICEF. UNICEF has its own emergency room, 24 hours a day, if there's threats to children in one place or another. And again, that may be a precursor, that may be a sign of bigger things to come. You've got UNIFEM working on sexual violence. Not in quite as many places, but in many places, and working on these things. You've got a special envoy for children in armed conflict, worried about child soldiers and looking about children being recruiting. Again, the kind of thing that could be indicative of a larger kind of a issue. So what we have in the UN is lots of information, but no place where it comes together. And no place that tries to look at it in this holistic way from all these different angles. So we want to create a small center that pulls together all the different information, analyzes it, reports directly to the Secretary General, and through the Secretary General to the Security Council or other bodies, and draws together different entities to talk about what are our policy options in one particular case or another. And the Secretary General has put great stress on what we need is early and flexible response. You know, we shouldn't wait until the bodies pile up. We need to be in there early, and we don't want to have a cookie-cutter approach, but tailor it to each situation, understand what's happening on the ground, what's happening in the politics, what's happening in the society. So a great emphasis on that. In addition to that, a great emphasis on trying to work in the development work within societies on those things, on those institutions, on those standards, on those principles within these societies to make them less likely to go down this sort of path. You know, why did Rwanda go to genocide in 1994 and Burundi next door with very similar ethnic composition, again a history of genocide, didn't quite get there? A lot of violence, but didn't quite get there. Why did one society go one way, the other society go the others? We're very much encouraging a state-to-state, country-to-country, region-to-region, organization-to-organization kind of a learning process. Where we have a philosophy of neighbors helping neighbors. It's not always New York or Washington that has to go in. It may be the African Union. Just last week, I was in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia talking to the African Union about this, and they're very, very enthusiastic about it. And so we think local action is often the key. We do believe that prevention is what is needed. The old idea of humanitarian intervention, one, was much too focused on the use of military force as the answer, and two, waiting until you could actually trigger the use of force politically, which meant you had to have stacks of bodies by that point. That's too late, and that's usually not the answer. You have to go in very early. So we're looking at a whole wide range of activities in peace building. The new peace building commission, its first two cases were Sierra Leone and Burundi, both that had suffered atrocities of one sort or another. And at that point, when you're rebuilding a society, you can try to put in place the kinds of things that will prevent recurrence of these kinds of violence. Finally, the last task, which is the ongoing one, is to bring the member states aboard. A lot of member states are very worried about their sovereignty, and they're very worried that responsibility to protect will be an excuse for big powers to intervene in little ones. For the countries with major military force to go in to others and use this as an excuse. I probably shouldn't mention which member state, but one of the five permanent members of the council recently invaded a neighbor to the south and said this was because of the responsibility to protect. That was not because of the responsibility to protect. It was not using this properly. But they said some of our nationals are being threatened there, and there are certain things happening, and therefore this gives us an excuse to intervene. Another member state, also one of the five permanent members, thought that after the cyclone Nargis in Myanmar this past spring, when the government wasn't responding there, that this was an R2P situation and we should respond, and maybe even militarily, because they weren't meeting the needs of their people. We thought this was a terrible human rights violation, and the Secretary General got involved and went to Myanmar and helped to open the door at least an inch or two. And indeed, enough foreign assistance got in. There wasn't enormous loss there. But we keep going back and saying, no, all that the member states have agreed to are four crimes and violations: genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. If it's those four things, it's R2P, and we need to act. But we can't stretch it any farther. We will not have member state support. We also discover there are other member states worried about their sovereignty in a different way. One of them is called the United States of America. You talk to people in Washington about this. Yes, we're very concerned about what's happening in these countries, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't want any rule that obligates us as a major military power to intervene in these kinds of situations. We think the principle is important, but we're worried about sovereignty in terms of our decision-making sovereignty. We want our independence in decision-making. We don't want to be told it's this kind of situation, you've got to interfere. So we have our problems with sovereignty, small countries have their problems with sovereignty. But I think by keeping this as a narrow concept, by stressing what we're trying to do is help the states to succeed, not simply reacting once they fail, that we're getting a more positive response. And we're working with the non-aligned movement and countries from the south, as well as countries from the north. And one of the things we keep arguing with people is this is actually not a northern concept. It's not a western concept. It really, in many ways, is a southern concept, a developing country concept. It really largely actually came from Africa. Because 5 years before the General Assembly and the World Summit endorsed Responsibility to Protect, the African Union, when it was first formed, in its Constitutive Act of 2000, has a very similar clause in it. It doesn't have ethnic cleansing, but it has the other three. It says there is a collective responsibility to intervene in those kinds of situations. The African Union, its predecessor, the OAU, the Organization of African Unity, the OAU argued for non-intervention. Under new leadership and the new organization, the AU, doesn't argue about non-intervention, it argues about non-indifference. We cannot be indifferent to what happens in our neighborhood. We're saying this in many ways. In fact, it would not have been passed in the summit or in the General Assembly in 2005 without very strong African and developing country support. I mean, anyone who thinks the US or Canada or others are going to force these ideas on the world has never visited the General Assembly. You have to have very strong support from the developing world. And that's actually where much of this came from. So we're saying this really is a southern issue as much as it is a northern issue, and we want to have all of them aboard. Now, I just actually handed in yesterday a major report, a draft to the Secretary General on Responsibility to Protect and how we're going to pursue it, and we hope to have a debate in the General Assembly on these various proposals, maybe March or so in the new year. We hope there'll be a little more positive atmosphere, partly because of the US election and because of the expectations that will bring. But also, we're looking very carefully about who should take leadership on this particular idea. And we're a little worried that with the new administration in Washington, this will get a Made in America kind of label. That there'll be a lot of energy and a lot of drive, which is terrific, but pretty soon this will be seen as a Made in Washington kind of proposal. We have a president-elect who's enormously articulate. If he picks this up, pretty soon everyone will forget what anything else anyone ever said because he will say it so well. But then that will then create some issues because this is not an issue of whether people just like America or not in other places. It is an issue of power and control. And there's real worries about American power. Now that we're bogged down in two wars and we're facing a recession, people may be a little less worried about us at the moment. But even under administration that some of them feel better about, if they feel the U.S. being too active, they feel the U.S. is going to dominate the political agenda, there will be pushback. And so we would like to see U.S. encouragement of this idea. We'd like to see the U.S. be behind it, and I think the U.S. very much will be. But if we know if the U.S. gets too far out in front, that may make some other major capitals that one can think of want to react, and they make many people in the developing world worry that, in fact, this will become an excuse for the exercise of American military might. And when one country spends about 45%, almost one half of all world military expenditures, people will make that connection. And so we've worked very, very hard to say this is not just about military intervention. At times that may be necessary. It's about all these other things as well. It's about all the things the world organization can bring and regional organizations can bring to this. And first and foremost, it is about the responsibility of the state. because states were not designed, were not created in order to persecute their people. States, among other things, were designed to offer protection for people. And sovereignty is something that does not just exist in the state, it also obviously exists in the people. And there was an understanding, a bargain in a way, between the sovereign authority and the people who gave the authority to that sovereign. And those who would go too far and abuse that, in fact, have violated the very notion of sovereignty and statehood. And we want very, very hard to return statehood to where it's supposed to be, which is responsibility for the populations on the territory. Not just the citizens, but the wording is the populations. Some of them may not be citizens. Some of them may be immigrants. Some of them may be refugees. Some of them may be illegal. But if they're on your territory, you have a responsibility to treat them properly. And we want to remind states of this day in and day out. So this actually becomes one of those norms, which is not just pronounced in the UN, but actually is acted on, and acted on by all the member states. So with that somewhat mixed message, I'd be very pleased to take your questions and comments. Thank you.
I'm going to move to the back of the room, and I would invite those who have questions, and I hope there are a number of good questions, as there usually are, to join me in the back of the room, and we will pose as many for Professor Luck as we have time to do. To start the conversation, Professor Luck, let me ask about the changing nature of the violence that threatens international stability. 30 or 40 years ago, most of these conflicts were between nation states or among nation states. Now they seem to be increasingly within the borders of a single area. How does this complicate the work, not only of those whose primary responsibility is R2P, but also other missions of the United Nations?
Well, it's often said, I think maybe a little too simplistically, that the UN was set up only to deal with conflict between nations. I think it was more than that. And I think a careful reading of the Charter and the discussions at Dumbarton Oaks and in San Francisco in 1945 suggests some understanding that, in fact, problems within states can lead to problems between states. And you have, for example, in the Charter under Article 34, the Security Council can undertake an investigation in any part of the world, even if there is not an existing threat to international peace and security, but a situation that might over time lead to one. But it is true that it's very difficult to solve problems within states. You just look at the problem now in Darfur and in Sudan. It's not even clear who you should be negotiating with. You know, mediation is terrific, and the UN and the AU and others are trying to do mediation in Darfur, but there are so many rebel groups that you don't even know which ones actually have authority. And as soon as you start a mediation, more of them come out of the woodwork because they want to get some of the goodies in terms of dividing power at the end of the day. So you end up splintering the groups even more because they have their own political competition. But I must say that this trend towards intrastate, and I think in many cases transnational conflict just spills over from one place to another. It may be fundamentally within a state. You take like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has been very sadly in the news this week, a lot of problems there. And then the war earlier attracted 9 different states in Africa, sending advisors, sending money, sending their own soldiers. So yes, it was an internal conflict in some ways, but it drew from the whole neighborhood in a very, very disruptive way. But this is not all that new for the UN. I mean, even you think of the DRC, the Congo was one of the first big and difficult peacekeeping operations for the UN back in the early 60s, where the UN actually went in, had to fight battles, had to decide the outcome, had to set up a governance structure. Many of the same things we're seeing today. And there's lots of experience now because these are very, very tough problems. And when you have really tough problems, they often get dumped at the UN at the end of the day because member states can't resolve them on their own, major powers don't have sufficient interest, so they dump it on the UN or they dump it on regional organizations. So a lot of experience has been built up, but that doesn't mean that it's easy. It's very tough to do, and particularly when you add this somewhat internal nature of these conflicts to the new targeting that I was mentioning earlier, where the UN, you know, a blue helmet is not a guarantee that you're going to be respected. It probably means that someone's going to go after you one way or the other. And we've seen this in Darfur with some of the rebel groups, among others, have attacked the UN, attacked the AU. It's not only the government in Khartoum, although obviously it's a big part of the problem. So I think it means that the mediation is more complicated. I think the post-conflict healing is more complicated and more important. And I think it probably means in most cases the international community stays a lot longer than any of us would like to see. And that then runs into the very difficult problem, how do you keep local ownership if you have to have an international presence there for some time to build up the infrastructure, to provide the services, to disarm the groups, demobilize them, and to deal with the process of reconciliation in the groups that are there. So what I think we found is that the UN ends up with a lot of partners in this kind of enterprise. The neighbors get involved, the regional, sub-regional organizations get involved, bilateral assistance gets involved. It gets to be very, very complicated. And that's why the new peace-building commission is so important, because there's two big outcomes from the summit in 2005. One was R2P, in that there was this amazing agreement that countries will actually do these things now, finally. And the second was that this institution was created to look at what happens when countries are trying to pull out of these kinds of conflicts and how do you put the pieces back together again. And I think the first rule is modesty. You know, we don't know as much as we should. We don't know why things work in some cases and don't work in others. And you need to have a deep, deep knowledge of the local culture and society and history before you go into meddle too much. Because it's rather easy to sit off in New York and, you know, design a plan for a country, you know, send our experts on constitutions, you know, who are certain people, I guess, around this part of the world know something about crafting constitutions. But, you know, there are differences, cultural differences than others in places. And so I think the UN has accumulated a lot of expertise, but the first piece of that expertise is knowing that we don't always know what we're doing.
A few years ago, the General Assembly voted to replace the UN Commission on Human Rights with the UN Human Rights Council because of its inability to enforce compliance on human rights concerns. Can you comment on the effectiveness of this transition?
The Human Rights Council. It's been frustrating, and I think it's been slow. And whether the old commission or the new council is working better, I think it's been a matter of opinion. One hears a bit on one side, one hears a bit on the other. The U.S., of course, is not a member. This might change with the new administration. The U.S. might decide to run, and under a new administration might, I think, have a pretty good chance of being elected to the Human Rights Council. I think that would be helpful. I don't think sitting outside being a critic is a proper role for the U.S. I think we should be involved very much in these kinds of bodies. But that's not going to solve the problems. Groups like the Human Rights Council will attract a lot of countries who do not want to see human rights enforced, who want to be there to protect their reputations, to ward off criticisms and action. But I think despite this, I think one of the important things to remember is that with the creation of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, which I think was about 92, 93, so it's only been maybe 15, 16 years now since it's been created, it's now quite an impressive bureaucracy. And the various human rights conventions have their own apparatus as well, and their own people. And one of the things we worry about is whether in the Human Rights Council there'll be an effort to crack down on the very good work being done by the Secretariat on human rights. And much of that work, of course, is done in conjunction with the private, nonprofit, independent human rights groups around the world. And that combination is a very powerful one. So a lot of states want to go in there and try to actually slow it up rather than speed it up. But that's inevitable. And so I think it just means those countries that really do have a deep commitment to human rights have to work all that much harder. And that means, you know, being part of it, not doing it from the outside and carping about it. So I think we see one possible a mechanism, a new one, the peer review mechanism, under the universal peer review mechanism, under the Human Rights Treaty, where in fact every country that runs to become a member of the council that is elected, and they're not all elected, will have to at some point in its tenure face review by other countries in terms of its performance. Now, we don't know whether this will end up being, you know, I'll look the other way on your problems if you'll look the other way on my problems. You know, there can be some of that. But there are also, I think, the number of countries is very dedicated on the Human Rights Council to making this peer review mechanism work. And there's a similar thing in Africa, an African peer review mechanism under NEPAD. And that's something we're actually looking at in terms of responsibility to protect, that one of the ways you can go about it is through peer review. You know, what are you doing to help? You know, this is what we've done to try to prevent these kinds of things from happening in our country. Maybe you might think about them in yours as well. So we think that's a mechanism that has some hope. And we think it's very important that those countries that care the most about human rights really dedicate themselves to making this new council work. And the U.S. insisted that one of the problems with the old commission was that it was too big. So they made it smaller. Well, the problem is they made it smaller, but many of those who were most determined to frustrate its work made sure that they were on that smaller group. And now the equation works against us. And most people now think it was a bad mistake. So the U.S. pushed very, very hard to get the number reduced and then didn't run itself and now is sitting back complaining about the results. So, you know, I think we should look at this again.
You mentioned earlier in your talk about the membership of the Security Council, and I had a question about that. I'd like to hear you discuss that further, if you would. The Security Council now is made up of China and the United States and Russia and two members of the European Union, but it doesn't include the two other great economic powers, Germany and Japan, and it doesn't include the second largest country population-wise, India, or nothing from South America like Brazil. And our present administration has been against expanding the Security Council, except maybe to include Japan. And I'm wondering if it should be expanded. Is there any chance that it could be expanded in the future with a new administration in the long term? And what are your views about possible future expansion of the Security Council?
Yeah, very good question. I mean, if I can definitely put on my academic hat to respond to that one, because it is very controversial with the member states. And unfortunately, I tend to get encyclopedic about this one, because I've written a lot about it. In fact, a recent book on the Security Council. And I was very involved in 96, 97, when Rezali Ismail from Malaysia was president of the General Assembly and asked me to come in to help design his proposals for Security Council reform, which is partly expansion, but partly changes in working methods. I am a little cautious about this, to tell you the truth. I have not seen any UN body that became stronger and more effective as it became bigger. So the idea of inclusion is very attractive, but the ultimate inclusion would be the General Assembly. And it's not clear to me that just adding more countries makes a body more effective. Among other things, in the particular area I work on, responsibility to protect, a lot of the countries you'd be adding as potential permanent members have not been very enthusiastic about responsibility to protect. And particularly if a lot of these countries are going to get a veto, not only in those issues but other issues, it's going to take longer to reach a decision. And the decision more often will be, you know, the lowest common denominator will get lower and lower as you add more major powers to the council. There also is a question about permanent seats to begin with. In 1945, we would not have had a UN without permanent seats and a veto. I know that the Soviet Union never would have joined without a veto. Stalin made that very, very clear. But the US, I think, both Roosevelt and Truman administrations are quite confident that Congress would not approve if there had not been a US veto and if it didn't have a permanent seat. And having the five permanent powers has done something, I think, quite extraordinary in human history. It has meant that five of the major military powers in the world have a continual forum that has now existed for 63 years where they talk about issues every day. And that's not a bad thing. Now, it doesn't mean that that club shouldn't be opened up. And it doesn't mean that today you'd pick the same five countries you did in 1945. You probably wouldn't. But I think the whole idea of permanence means that a country is basically unaccountable to others. It's a little as if we had a permanent president. We wouldn't have elections every 4 years and hold them accountable. You know, Congress, it is there all the time. You wouldn't reelect your House members every 2 years. You need to have some flow to make countries accountable. Now, having five countries accountable is bad enough. Having six, eight, 10 countries unaccountable, I think, would be that much worse. So I'd be careful about it. To me, the Security Council, for all of its faults, has been an extraordinary organ and really totally unprecedented in human history in terms of what it's been able to accomplish. Now, we often look at the half-empty part of the glass, but the half-full part, I think, also is quite impressive. And so I would reform it in several ways, but I do so carefully. I would certainly look at the possibility of seats, for example, that could be renewed. As you know, now 2 years and you're out, and you can't immediately run for re-election. So one possibility is amending the charter so you could run for immediate re-election. So you'd still be accountable, but if you're a country like Japan, which seems to be very good at winning elections in the UN, you would serve very, very often. And maybe other countries like India or other might have the chance to serve very, very often. Because one of the problems is not just the veto, but the knowledge that is built up by being there all the time. And in addition to that, I would look very much at expanding the non-permanent members somewhat. You know, you get too big, I think you become dysfunctional. There are a lot of arguments when the council went from 11 to 15. It's been expanded once, expanded in 1965. And the U.S. has favored, you know, 21, 22. As a number, which I think is not unreasonable. Maybe a little bigger than that, but I wouldn't go much bigger than that. So that combination, I think, would make a difference. What I think would make the biggest difference is changing the working methods of the council. Make it more open, make it more accountable. So make it more inclusive, not just in who's a member, but who participates in the meetings and the debates. There are now, under the Security Council, now 27 subsidiary bodies. So it's got a big infrastructure under that very few people see. Almost all of those are chaired by non-permanent members, not by the five, but by the 10. And that gives them a certain responsibility and a certain role. Some of them involve fairly often, not quite on a regular basis, but fairly often, non-members of the council in their deliberations. And that's the sort of thing I would encourage, more involvement of the troop contributing countries, so those that are actually putting their troops out in harm's way, which of course the US is not. We have only a, you know, dozens of people in UN peacekeeping, while you know, the great bulk of UN peacekeepers come from the developing countries, particularly India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. And the US and Western Europe lay way behind. So you know, I would open up the council some, but I'd be a little careful about the permanent seats myself.
In the example you gave earlier about a member state invading a neighbor, under the auspices of our R2P, are there repercussions that are fundamentally would prevent that from happening in the UN? That's my question.
Yeah, very good question. I mean, obviously, when this sort of thing happens, it doesn't help those of us who are trying to persuade the 192 member states that this is a concept that they should endorse in practice, not only in theory, because there is a problem of abuse. But the argument we make, which at least we find persuasive, is that if you want to discourage abuse of this kind of a concept, you have to develop a credible multilateral alternative. Standing by and wringing our hands as hundreds of thousands of people are killed is not satisfactory, saying, oh, well, but we're respecting the process. You know, someone's going to veto it in the Security Council, or you know, someone's uncomfortable because politically they don't want to draw attention to this. You know, that's not satisfactory. And I don't think the public respect for the organization will remain if we continue on that path. So you have to have a credible multilateral alternative. If it takes military force, and sometimes it may take an application of military force, or I think more often a combination of military, police, and civilians, an early and targeted injection in some cases, or you need to have a preventive deployment like we had in Macedonia, or you actually have a deployment which is coercive but helps the government. Like in Sierra Leone, it wasn't the government that was committing the atrocities, it was the RUF that was cutting off all the limbs. So you needed to send UN forces, and they didn't quite do the job. So then the British went in, and then the UN in went a little stronger, and they were able to defeat the RUF and stop the atrocities. But you should have a multilateral way of doing that. If you simply say, oh, no, we don't want to think about that option, then you leave it to big powers to do it on their own. So what we argue is you need to have it well defined what it is and isn't. It's these four crimes and violations and nothing else. And say so. And I've said it twice now in my short tenure in this job, against the wishes of two permanent members. So I'm only glad that I'm not a Secretary General who has to look for approval for a second term, because I don't like this sort of thing, obviously. But it has to be said, and you have to keep it narrow. It's very, very important. Second of all, you have to have procedures and rules for how you go about this, including in decision making. And we say again and again and again, it has to be under the charter and under charter rules. If you have a blockage in the Security Council, someone's casting a veto, you can look at the Uniting for Peace resolution and have it handled by the General Assembly. The General Assembly can't take binding actions in enforcement the way the Security Council can, but it can call on member states to do things, and it has. I think it's about 12, 13 occasions now the Assembly has used the Uniting for Peace. So we say build the multilateral alternative, build multilateral processes, define it really clearly, stick to it, and that'll make it harder for others to violate the meaning of it.
Thank you very much for a very interesting and informative talk. Let me precede my comments by saying I'm a great admirer of the United Nations. In 1948, my family and I were forced to leave Palestine. And unfortunately, we could not pack our lands and buildings on our shoulders and take them with us. But after we got to Lebanon, we were fortunate enough to receive the rations from the United Nations, which kept us alive for a while. My question is really very simple. There are hundreds and hundreds of resolutions regarding Palestine and the refugees. Will the United Nations ever get teeth?
Very good question. And I think it's worth pointing out, since you mentioned the relief operation there, very few people realize that is the UN's largest operation in terms of number of employees, in terms of money, and in terms of relief effort. Of course, it's been going on far, far too long. It's become so permanent that it makes it easier for people not to resolve the problems because the UN is helping to add a little bit of stability and quite a bit of humanitarian assistance there. I don't know whether the UN needs teeth on Palestine and the Middle East, because I'm not sure it's that kind of a problem. I think it is an intense and deep political schism that requires not only patience, but very skilled diplomacy, and also requires individual countries and groups involved that can bring some things to the table the UN can't. That may be very large economic incentives. It may be some security guarantees that the UN itself cannot bring. So the UN, of course, is part of the quartet in the Middle East. But I wouldn't claim that it's the most powerful part of the quartet. But I'm quite confident that when we do get to a real, lasting, durable peace in the Middle East, that the UN would be part of the solution and not part of the problem. But it would not only be the UN. The UN would be a piece of the puzzle and a critical piece of the puzzle. One of the problems we obviously have in the region is we don't have regional and sub-regional organizations one can call on that are universal and that have the confidence of all the parties. So it's a very different situation than we have in many parts of Africa and many other parts of the world. But of course, we don't have those precisely because of the kinds of political problems that we have. I don't know of any issue that occupies more of UN attention or creates more angst within the body and within the Secretariat than these issues do. I think it's important that the UN try to remain impartial on these issues, try to be an honest broker that all sides can trust. I wouldn't be surprised if someday we see some UN peacekeepers, some kind of UN peace operation on the ground in the Middle East. When, one doesn't know, you know, we're not there politically. The UN, unfortunately, isn't in a position to create the political conditions necessary for it to be successful. And the political conditions there are not there for it to be successful yet. But I think when those political conditions come together, the views of the UN all of a sudden will be a lot more pragmatic from all sides of this. And I do think the UN will be part of the solution. I mean, even now, you know, you still have UN peacekeepers and the Golan Heights. You have a very large UN peacekeeping operation in Lebanon, which is the only place in the world we have major NATO and European contingents in a UN peacekeeping operation now. So I think that shows that when push comes to shove and you're beginning to look for a solution, people do look to the UN to be part of that solution.
I have a question pertaining to something that you mentioned earlier on in your presentation, and that is that for all the great rhetoric that the UN is able to put together in its resolutions, oftentimes we find that they're unable to deliver for various reasons, whether it pertains to member states not living up to their contributions or their obligations or whatnot. So my question is, what recommendations would you make, or what provisions are there in the responsibility to protect that would hold member states, or perhaps in particular permanent members of the Security Council, accountable to living up to their obligations or actually contributing to different peacekeeping operations or missions around the world?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I'm glad we have the youth vote. We're balancing the demographics here. The UN is a voluntary association of sovereign states. It doesn't have the kind of powers to compel them to do what it would like them to do. In some ways, that's an obvious weakness for the organization. But oddly enough, I think in other ways, it's actually a long-term strength. I don't know of any other international institution that has lasted this long dealing with this range of issues. You know, it's really endless for the organization. Through the Cold War, through the post-Cold War era, whatever Pax Americana we thought we had for a few years, to whatever ill-formed situation we have now in the world. And the UN is always part of the furniture of international relations. It's really quite extraordinary. People often ask me in a different way, why are you still working on the UN? You know, don't you have anything better to do? I had my first internship at the UN in 1971 when I was a graduate student at Columbia. And it is, as I said, an endlessly frustrating place. But it is also one that earns enormous respect around the world. It's really quite extraordinary. And that still has a legitimacy to it, despite its inability to deliver so often on its promises. And I think that's because the principles that it stands for and the fact that it not only has purposes and principles built into the charter that really are, you know, ageless and enormously attractive to people around the world, but the fact that it is universal, virtually universal, that you bring the oddest group of member states together to fight with each other, you know, it's a good thing to have that place to do that. So I would say, you know, if you had to say, okay, over the last 63 years, has the UN made more of a difference on the normative side, or has it made more difference on the operational delivery side? I'd probably argue more on the normative side, and I think the difference matters much more. I'm sure we would not even have human rights as a concept if it wasn't for the UN. You know, before the Universal Declaration, before the Genocide Convention, before all the other the declarations, whatever, there was no real codified sense of human rights, and certainly none that had even a pretense of being universally valid. That's an extraordinary accomplishment. Decolonization was very much a UN project. One very controversial divided the U.S. from its closest allies among the five permanent members. The whole development regimen, humanitarian affairs. You look at much of disarmament that has come through the UN and the norms through the UN. And now all the efforts, you know, peacekeeping didn't exist. It was a UN invention. All these peace operations now, you know, we have sky-high expectations for them, and you know, more often than not, they don't meet those expectations. But, you know, I think the fact that the UN keeps trying is what really matters. And on R2P, we can't compel member states to do what we want them to. But I think if we create a standard and a norm which is so widely respected, over time, people begin to understand, yes, if we want to be a properly respected member state sitting around the table, we have to do certain things. And among those things are not to commit these kinds of atrocities against our people. If we do, there will be consequences. And one of the things we argue in the Secretary General's report, that whether there's sanctions by the Security Council, by the General Assembly, whatever, there will be individual sanctions. People will not travel there. People will not invest there. People look at long-term risk. They don't want to invest in places that are going through things like genocide. You know, there's no legitimacy for a regime who do these things to their people. So I think those standards matter because they form the politics which over time determine what is national interest. And I think what we conceive of national interest today is very different than 20, 30 years ago people thought of national interest. And I think 20, 30 years from now will be that much different. And I do think that R2P will be one of those things. And it's going to be one of those things because the political costs of not doing something about these things are going to be great, not only for the country or the rebel group that's committing the atrocities, but for the rest of us for standing back and doing nothing. You know, people say if Rwanda happened today, like it did in 94, would we all look the other way? You know, because we had problems in Somalia, we don't want to look at what's happening in Rwanda. I don't think so. I think things would be different today. One, we have a Secretary General who is really, really focusing in on this with laser-like concern. He does not want his tenure to suffer the same kinds of things that happened with Kofi Annan, who was a terrific Secretary General in many ways, but he had Rwanda, he had Srebrenica, he had stains there that I know to these days trouble him deeply. And the Secretary General doesn't want to go through that, doesn't want the organization to go through that. And he says, we can do better. And the fact that there's so many groups in universities, so many groups around the world, you know, transnational groups, and not just in the West or the North, because when I travel to the South, developing countries, it's amazing how much interest there is in these things and how much organization is going on in these things. So the public will eventually force governments to pay attention to these things. And that's where it's going to make a difference. It's not because we write in a rule. It's not because the Security Council occasionally gets around to doing something about it. It's because the politics is going to change. I think politics is already changing. And, you know, I think we saw that again last night. So thank you for your question.
With this change in administrations and changing conditions in the world, I think the United Nations will play an increasingly prominent role in the formation of our foreign policy. And we're deeply grateful for your focusing our attention on the possibilities. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.